have two lovely guests on with me tonight, or this afternoon, rather, this evening. What does it count?
This afternoon.
Twilight.
They were already going for it out on the sidewalk, so I anticipate it's going to be fairly spicy, so stick around. We've got Robert Chimshack, a collector here in San Francisco and internationally as well, and Stephen Wolf from Stephen Wolf Fund. I've had Stephen on before, and I'm butchering his gallery name. I was handily reprimanded for that.
Rightly so.
Why don't you guys give a brief introduction of who you are and maybe what you do?
Well, I'm a physician in real life, but I'd like to think that my real career is art. I came to the avocation of collecting art in sort of a sneaky backroads way through all those childhood things that kids do. Either you have the sort of collecting genes or you don't have the collecting genes. I grew up in this old house with many old things in it that my family never threw anything out. So I started with all these little collections that kids do. First I did the stamps, then I did the coins, then I did the baseball cards, then I did the science fiction books, then I did all these other things that kids collect. Until finally, one day I happened to be at a flea market and I encountered a photograph that spoke to me because of its history. The next thing you know, it led me down the whole path of different things, and there I was collecting art. Somebody said, "Oh, you're an art collector." So I'm an art collector, and I've used that to go many different ways. I've done collecting. It's let me do the things I want. Curating. It's let me do be on boards to help artists, help communities. I also wound up running a photo archive for photography and belongings, and edited several photo books. So it's been very rewarding for me in many, many ways.
What about yourself, Steve?
I thought that was going to be like a two-word answer, and I could see I'm going to have to like assert myself if I'm going to get in anything here. I am a speed freak dumpster diver in real life, and then I run an art gallery downtown on the side.
What flavor speed do you use? Would be the coffee?
I don't know enough about drugs to answer that. I was lying. Can you pose the question?
I can absolutely pose the question. One of the things that you guys share in common, obviously, is love of art. But perhaps a different angle is that, Stephen, your gallery tends to show pretty conceptual pieces recently, as in the last piece that was showing at your place. Something that can't necessarily be bought. Would you mind elaborating on?
Well, it can be bought, but it hasn't been bought yet. In any sense of the word, I don't think people have even bought into it as an idea. I actually show lots of objects and, you know, conventional works of art, you know, that are, I feel like they're not necessarily conceptual. Conceptual is such a loaded phrase because, to my mind, it's more of a historical concept than an ongoing category full of life that's being worked now. The show that I currently have is actually a video show, and there are, you know, four or five short films for sale that have all been made and feature the identical twins Kevin and Kent Young, and the basis of which is their telepathic connection, or their special connection. It's sort of the subtext.
It's all right.
I don't even know what that word means. I forgot before I did this show to look it up in the dictionary, so I feel like, you know, I'm one of those people, I feel like I should know what the word means if I'm going to use it. But the main part, the interest, one of the interesting features of the show, not that, whatever, is this performance they did in which they tried to solve a crossword puzzle without communicating conventionally, but only through telepathy, as it were.
ESP.
ESP, exactly. And I was the control for this experiment, so I know it was honest. And I gave them a crossword puzzle without the clues. They made a big screen print of it. And then the night of the performance, when they sat down on other sides of the partition, I gave one twin the clues, and the other twin got to stand in front of the puzzle, and they got to try to do the puzzle. And I think they're the first people in history to make the claim that there's no right or wrong answer in a crossword puzzle.
And that's basically what came out of it.
I mean, question, obviously, that jumps to mind is, how many did they get?
Well, that's the whole point.
Come on, there's nothing to get.
There's no black and white answer. It's there are answers and in different shades of gray. they didn't actually, you know, it. That's because this is what people keep asking me, did it work or didn't it work? I mean, there are actually three stages. There were three stages of development in this crossword puzzle, and I can see I'm doing exactly what I was accusing you of.
I've not enjoyed this.
Three stages of development. This is all I have to say. I've run out of stuff after this. There are three stages of development in this, and this is the only thing I remember because I've been chattering about this in the gallery for the last 2 weeks. If you ask me
about any of my other artists, I wouldn't know what to say.
We'll get there. Don't you worry.
Three stages of development in this crossword puzzle. In the first stage, like one twin would come up with one word to answer the question, and the other twin would come up with another word, and you'd sort of, you know, mash them together and get kind of like a surrealist diptych poem. Two words that don't really go together but make a kind of interesting sound. Like there was one, I think seven down was clear grasp, and 21 across was like soap kiss. So it's kind of like, what does this mean? Nothing really, but it's, you know, mellifluous language. It's, you know, not even really close to logic, but it's just a kind of interesting sonic experience.
Now, did you put collector in there so somebody could give the definition?
I didn't monkey with the puzzle at all. This came straight out of like a New York Times puzzle book. Those kinds of answers occurred in the first, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of their puzzle solving, because this was a 45-minute performance. In the second phase, they came up, you know, there were a couple of interesting answers. One was, the question was Camden Fields Yard, which is the Baltimore Orioles baseball field, and one came up with home run, and the other one came up with running into fire. And so you have this, you know, example of a sort of slight overlap and a kind of, you know, mysterious connection. Another interesting one was, I can't remember, it was like 28 down. One came up with the words diva and choir, and the other one came up with the word vehicles. And you can almost construct meaning out of that by saying, well, divas and choirs are vehicles for the word of God. So you get into this kind of, like paranoia situation where, can I invest this coincidence with meaning? It's kind of like reading a Thomas Pynchon novel. Is there something there? Is there, or am I imagining it? And so that second stage was sort of like the paranoia meaning construction phase. And then in the third phase, you get into these issues of, the question was, Eli's school, and the guy who had the clues wrote Yale, rightly, and the guy who didn't have the clues wrote Yale. Now, at Yale, they yell Eli at the ball games. So that, now you're getting into an area of statistics, science, and mystery, because it's a completely overdetermined statistical, you know, thing that happened. And they did it again on this other one. I think it was like 31 down. The phrase was blank greens, and the guy with the clues wrote leafy, and the guy with the board wrote left. And so the greens, of course, are on the left of the political spectrum, but you think they've got three out of four letters. That's too close. Now, that happened twice towards the end of the performance, and so finally, this screen print had become like a very flat, two-dimensional sort of encapsulation of chance, coincidence, meaning, paranoia, statistics, a really interesting painting, you know, a really interesting record of a performance, analogical to kind of like what the abstract expressionists used to do when they would sort of, those paintings were records of like physical painting performances. This was a record of a performance, and it was totally successful, and not a single answer was right.
But don't you think
that's a short answer?
Don't you think this brings up the issue of conceptual art as maybe people don't understand. It becomes a joke when it becomes too intellectual, and people forget about the beauty of the work itself. I mean, for me, I happen to be a big fan of conceptual art, and there's a lot of conceptual art. It's easy to have an idea in a way, but it's very hard to have an idea that meets the same rigorous qualifications for beauty that any other great artwork does. And to me, that when I look at something like a Salowit drawing or a Fred Sandbeck sculpture that are somewhat minimal and conceptual in nature, I mean, they're fabulous because they're beautiful. They're not fabulous because they have a great idea, although that's a large part of it.
What's interesting about that issue, and I think we've talked about it, is what it is, what happens to a people, a tribe, let's say the art-going and art-collecting tribe, that in that they go from being like, you know, a group of people who decide that, you know, a Fauvist painting or a, you know, impressionist painting is beautiful, is like an aesthetic experience and a visual aesthetic experience, to thinking Fred Sandbach or a Saul LeWitt or a certain Bruce Nauman's, like somehow that work comes to take on like the category of visual beauty. And what I'm interested in is what has to happen to us in order for that to be the case. When you started out as a collector, did you find Saul LeWitt's work, you know, visually beautiful? And now do you, as opposed to now, where you might experience it that way?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I think sometime in your collecting life you get a revelation, hopefully. And I think it happened to me when I started. I was searching. I really didn't know how to look in some ways. But what I started feeling was, you know, I started off first, I wanted work that was made well. Right. Well, it's okay. And that gets you a certain space. But then you want something that does more. And the work that made it was a revolution for me. It changed my whole way of seeing. It was a work by Edward Shea that I came upon in the early 80s. It was one of those gunpowder drawings. And I looked at it, it was beautifully made, and I loved it for all the wrong reasons to begin with. Because it was lovely, it was handcrafted, it was very special. But when I got home, I realized it was about something else. It was about time, it was about thoughts and words and so many other levels. And so it moved me to try to understand what this conceptual art was really all about. And, you know, it was a revelation to me. And that's, I mean, through the career of collecting, I think about all the shows that there aren't that many where I just walked into the room, and all of a sudden there was something about it that said, this is really great. I can think of something like the Jenny Holzer show at the Dia Center, where she did her laments, where I thought it was radical when I first walked into Carol Walker's studio in Providence, Rhode Island, where something happened where I really saw the work. And then, you know, and that's the kind of thing that's hard to come by. And, you know, once you can see it, I think, you have a better chance of seeing it again.
I have a question. I have a question for the doctor.
You
know, I've been through your collection and like done the incredibly ill-mannered thing of asking what you paid for stuff. Because really, like, that's what everybody wants to know. And I was shocked to find that many of your, you know, I'm going to call them masterpieces, were extremely well bought. And I'm curious about, not like, how do you get stuff so cheap, but like, when you're at an artist's...
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about.
Yeah, not in my gallery. You're dealing with an artist who really hasn't been discovered yet, like, what is the thing, because I know you've gone through my gallery and not bought the stuff, but what is the thing that goes on in your mind that tells you to go ahead and buy this thing that hasn't been validated by the market yet, but, you know, you feel like, you know, what bell goes off? What is it that finally grips you where you can separate yourself from, you know, all the other collectors who aren't acting and go ahead and do it?
Wow. The audience is timing me down on this one. This is a tough one. No, but I think there is something. First of all, nothing appears out of a vacuum. And, you know, occasionally you do go to some, you know, graduate school, you know, show and find a first-year grad student you think is great. But that doesn't happen. I mean, most of the artists that, you know, you're seeing early on, they have some sort of record of some kind. So what I do is I get around a lot. I look at a lot of things. I go all around the world. I talk to people. The first thing, when I first started collecting, you know, I thought about it. I'm a doctor. What would I do if I wanted to find a good doctor? I'd ask me, to recommend a doctor, and I'd probably find a good doctor. So what I started doing was I would go to art openings, and I'd start talking to artists. I'd say, well, other than your own work, which is terrific, whose work do you really like? So they would start telling me, and I'd start looking. If I started hearing the same name over and over again, I'd start going to look at that artist's work. And I still, you know, you still kind of feel that buzz. I mean, I talk to people that I really respect, and there are a fair number of them in the world. A lot of them are artists, a lot of them are dealers, a lot of them are curators, a lot of them are museum directors, whatever. I take the information wherever I can get. So I'm pretty good at feeling the zeitgeist of things. In a way, so you can feel that little bit of buzz coming up somewhere. Right. You know, if you start hearing the name over and over again, you start thinking there's something maybe going on here. And better look right away. I think the important thing is to seize on the moment and really, you know, act and trust your judgment. So that's the hard part. It's not so much that these artists are coming to Novo from nowhere. It's just that you have to you know, given some information, you have to decide in your own heart whether this is something you really love. And that's what I think that's the way I do it, in a way. I take all the information I get, I apply it. That's like insider information, you know. And that world is the last place, where insider information is not only legal, but it's absolutely required. You have to have it. You have to know people. You have to see things. You have to know what the buzz is. You have to know what's going to be shown at the museums. You have to know what's happening. If you don't know what's happening, you're gonna lose.
How important do you think knowing an artist and actually like meeting that artist is?
Knowing the artist is really important to me. When I went to Carol Walker's studio, she just had her first graduate show. I had her graduate show, and you know, she had just taken the works off the wall, and I went there because. Annie Philbin, who was a curator, a great curator and a friend of mine, said, well, she'd seen the work and she thought it was really good. I should look at it. And I was going to Providence, Rhode Island anyway. But when I walked in, I talked with Karen, and I could see that, you know, this woman had great ideas. This woman was brilliant. This work was about something. You know, there was a lot of substance to it, and that she was going to be continually making this work in 15 years or 20 years from now. I'll get the feel from an artist by talking to them, whether they're intelligent, whether there's more than one idea, whether they're dedicated, what's coming from the heart, all of those things. I think that's really important to me.
So longevity is definitely something you look for as well, as obviously as a collector.
I look at a lot of things. I look at the work, and longevity of the artist. I mean, if the artist quits, and that happens to a lot of artists, they just get discouraged and they disappear. You know, I always talk about the emerging artists. I always talk about the submerging artists. there are artists who just sink themselves. You know, by doing something stupid. I'll give you an example. There was an artist. Nobody in the room. I'll give you an example. I won't mention the artist's name. In the East Village days, there's this wonderful, wonderful artist who was making great work. It was a huge line for his work. I wanted one desperately. And the gallery sold them all out. So the artist was feeling really big. So he decided, the artist had a girlfriend, decided he was going to make collaborative work with this girlfriend. And he had an next show, and the work was terrible, because half of it was done by a bad artist and half of it was done by a good artist. So the artist learned that that wasn't such a good idea. So the dealer taught them to making big paintings because they had to be more expensive. So instead of making these darling, small, fabulous little paintings, he made big paintings. Not a single one sold. The waiting list disappeared, and he never had another show again. Oh. That was it. It's a sad story.
That is a sad story.
So artists can kill themselves.
Steven, artists that kill themselves, you had any that committed suicide on your doorstep?
I have some that have worked their way out of the gallery, though, through personality conflict.
How important is that, being a nice guy versus making awesome work?
It depends for me on how much I have to deal with them. If it can all be done like through email, I'm not, you know, that fussy about a person. Although the artists that tend to want to work with me, they all tend to be sort of grim, humorous, dry, phlegmatic, sarcastic, you know, souls.
Would you say Ray?
Like spirits.
Ray Potez fits in that category.
Not at all. No. You're right. He's not that. Well, he's not. He's much more buoyant.
Tell us a little bit about Hammer Eyes. They're pretty hot item right now. They're San Francisco's darlings. No.
Uh, You know, I they are actually. It's a great magazine. It's a magazine devoted to traditional black and white photography. But somehow it doesn't look traditional at all. It looks really fresh. It's I told you not to ask you about the artists I haven't shown in the last 2 weeks.
Wait, talk to us about crossword puzzles.
Yeah. No, Hammer Rise is great, and we had a great time showing it. The installations are these large-scale floor-ceiling hung, you know, crazy quilt, full-on experiences. And there's an incredible consistency in the work, given the number of works in a show. And there tends to be, you know, it's like I think in, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, people will look back at Hamburger Eyes as a kind of time capsule for San Francisco, because it seems in its broadness and its kind of, you know, sort of the way it lurches at trying to capture life here, I think they're onto something. They've captured some intangible thing about this, you know, the sort of urban experience of San Francisco. It might be weighted a little bit towards the nocturnal and the sort of, you know, mission side of things, rather than, you know, the boardrooms and bourgeois bedrooms of Pacific Heights. But there's something captured in Hamburger Eyes that I think will have a really lasting quality.
Robert, did you see the Hamburger Eyes show?
I've seen Hamburger Eyes work at Yerba Buena and some other places. I didn't actually see the show at the gallery, but it is interesting work. I work with an artist that in some ways is similar to Hamburger Eyes. The artist is our cover on Bill Owens, who kind of characterized the suburban scene in the 70s here in the Bay Area. So I think that this idea of a time capsule is a very valid thing to have. I want to go back to the relationship with the artists a little bit, because I mean that's one of the main things I've gotten out of collecting is it's not just meeting artists and knowing they're going to be successful. It's because you certainly can buy an artist and want to buy artists that are great, are making great art. You don't have to like them. And in fact, I mean, that's not one of the criteria. You don't like them, you don't buy their work. I mean, that's not the way it works. But one of the byproducts of this is all the people who do meet and become your friends. I mean, people like Bill Owens, or people like Jim Hodges, whose work I've been collecting since he was young. And, you know, you wind up doing things like when we had a show in Spain, a whole group of friends and collectors, as we all flew to Spain, they had dinner for the night. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful community. The art community becomes a family in a great way. I mean, I met my wife and Bill on the same night, the same opening in San Francisco, and it was a great night. I mean, it affected my whole life and sent me down a road I would have never gone. So I owe a lot to collecting art, and I think it's about the people. And it's, you know, the art is in a way certainly one of the products. But the people involved in that are great people. They're interesting. They're fascinating. They're here, like we're here today to talk to interesting people. It's great.
I'll agree with that. And I actually used to have a much more successful, financially successful business just trading, blue chip and secondary market art commodities. But it was pretty empty. And I find that it's a much more challenging thing to present and sell younger artists and artists who are there, you know, who I actually work with. But I would never go back to doing it the other way. I'm having way more fun, and it's largely because of, you know, the people that I work with. And even actually, Bob's right. When you're in it for a while and you start to meet the people who are sort of in it for the long haul, they tend to be interesting people, and you tend to form bonds with them that kind of transcend just the objects. Because half the time, I find that I'm just the custodian for a thing to get it to the next generation because I care about it, I think it's valid, and without me, it might not stay alive. And I truly used to find stuff in the streets. And I used to think, like, well, if I didn't find it, it was really just going to get, you know, kicked in the curb, but I'm going to save it, hand it off to somebody, and they'll, you know, save it for the next 10 or 20 years. But in a sense, I feel like I still do that. Some of this some of the things I work with, like the artists may not be doing work if they're not getting, you know, shows in galleries like mine, and then it's just one less thing that will ever get created and happen and survive.
So I knew we were compadres in this this idea. We all feel like we're saving, as a collector or even as a dealer, we're paying our dues to impose our taste in mind another generation. What's saved is what's considered later on. Right. I mean, I think that's a really important factor in it all.
We're easy targets for lots of critics actually who identify kind of like, you know, life in America as one giant sort of curatorial activity. We're all just on display, curating our lives, displaying ourselves to others through what we own and what we do. But, I think in so many ways, in especially in our kind of democracy, there aren't a lot of other options. We don't have a lot of great political options to act out. And so this is one, controlling the display of things around you and that kind of activity is like, it's sort of pathetic to say it, but that's a fairly political act and a valid one and one of the few that were really allowed.
Speaking of which, Robert, sorry, you, what is your taste on political art? do you collect anybody who makes political stuff?
Well, that's very interesting. I usually avoid it like the plague. The reason for avoiding political art is it's all about now, right? Most of the time. It's very, very hard to make a Goya work, like work. I mean, the work that transcends time. So you buy a work with Richard Nixon on it, or you bought a work that's, who cares about Richard Nixon anymore? The people forget the political figures that were involved. So if you're gonna make political art, it has to be universal. When I look at any work of art, and this is kind of weird, but I mean, I look at it, it's about time. Is there a connection to the past? Is there a connection to the future? Is it talk to now? So I would ask myself, I look at this picture, what would people have thought about it 20 years ago? What do people think about it now? What would people think of it 50 years from now? And if I think that people will consider it in those times, I will buy it, including political art. And I do have a few political works. I've had works by Sue Coe and a few political artists, but it's very rare that I find a work that I feel will transcend time with its imagery.
I largely agree, although there are some obvious exceptions like Warhol's Manhattan and certain kind of portraiture, Barbara Kruger, I think. When I see politicians in pictures, I do tend to turn off because the bar is set so high on dealing well with it, and it's generally, it's rarely dealt with well. I guess I'm more interested in the politics of the image rather than politics itself in art, because the gallery space doesn't seem to be the best space to deal with politics. I mean, it's more, I think the newspaper is a better place. So there are other, I mean, politics, there's no space that one shouldn't deal with politics, but it seems like not, the frontal approach is rarely the best.
Yes.
One.
Best taken from behind, I hear. sorry, that's a horrible comment.
Well, it's true. Yeah, I know. Take it there. Just bend over. All right.
I'm sorry, but I think that's all the time we have. This has been Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr. You're listening to 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. The lovely guests today have been Stephen Wolf from Stephen Wolf Fine Arts and Robert Shimshak, a well-known collector in town and doctor as well. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Effort.
Thank you.